now on to this session on past lives, hypnosis, and psychic phenomena. Are you interested? Good. If you fall asleep, you might have just been hypnotized. The first speaker is a Sri Lankan. When he was young, he was spontaneously coming out with chanting of sutras. That's quite amazing considering how difficult that is to learn chanting, even at our age. So for more than 35 years, he's been associated now with many world-renowned Dharma teachers, and one of which is Venerable Gunaratana, whom he ordained under for a little while as a samanera. And he's a graduate of the Insight Meditation Society teacher training program, and he founded the Niroda Trust and Niroda City, at the Niroda City Center. So he now teaches worldwide, and before we invite him up to speak, we're going to hear a recording of his chanting when he was a child. So can we have that, please? Thank you. That sounded really cute. So now let's look at the older version of Damaruan. Welcome, please.
So it's nice to be here once again in Perth. Perth is not a new place for me. I have had many meditation retreats here. I think three retreats at the beautiful Jhana Grove of Achan Brahms. And when these chantings are played, there are two questions that everybody asked me, and these two questions I have heard from my childhood. And the first question is, even after they listened to it, they asked me, are you the one who chanted that? So the answer is yes. And what is the second question people ask? Second question you ask is, do you still have that memory? Do you still can chant that? So sometimes I answer that with by saying, not right now. So it's a privilege to come here to talk about the past lives. Although past lives is not my area of teaching, I teach Vipassana meditation, and it's a privilege to be here. It's wonderful speakers, list amazing people, and beautifully organized, and I'm really enjoying myself here, and I'm really excited. I don't know what I would say much, but I'm excited what might come out. Before I have, just to keep to the time limit, I want to take this chance to talk about two things that is about this topic. Otherwise, after that I will definitely talk about myself. So, what are the two things I want to talk about is that the conflict, because this thing is about conflict and resolving conflict with mindfulness. So when we talk about conflict, although several speakers have talked about this, listening to everything yesterday, what happened, I thought of just adding on few footnotes to that, so that you will get some more information. So there is this, when you talk about conflict, there is always, we always think about the external conflict, outer conflict. So, the outer conflict is the conflicts that we have problems about, and we talked about yesterday. But Buddha was more involved with the inner conflict. So, when you look at the outer conflict only, you can understand, you have to go and find the inner conflict and find resolutions for inner conflict. What do I mean by inner conflict? That means everything that we have problem with originate from here. What is the biggest conflict in your life? What can be the biggest conflict in your life? Biggest problem in your life? Biggest issue in your life? You. For me, I am the biggest conflict in my life. Currently, every one of us is thinking about something. I'm trying to think about my conflict right now is to deliver a good speech, so that you will enjoy it, so that you will have some information. Your conflict might be something to understand this. So there is always an inner conflict, however small it is, it's happening in us. So the conflict is in ourselves. And how to deal with this conflict is to learn to let go. That's how you resolve the conflict. Otherwise, conflict will keep on going on and on and on. So I remember many years ago, when I first came to Australia, I think first or second time, I was quite young, I was a teenager, and I came to, from Sri Lanka, I came to Sydney to participate in a retreat by Bhante Gunaratna, Penipola Gunaratna. And I was training under him at that time. And we were having a retreat at Blue Mountains in Sydney. Bhanteji came from America, and I came from Sri Lanka to be his assistant. And the retreat was going on, and those of you who have done meditation retreats, you know that it's in silence, and it's a really challenging job to do a retreat. How many of you have done retreat here? Yeah, quite a lot. So you know it's a challenging thing, and one of the main things is sleepiness. You feel so sleepy the first few days, and you just, when you meditate, you try to watch your breath, and suddenly you go, and it's scary. When that happens, it's as if you are sitting on a cliff. Your whole life depends on, you know, that, not to go down like that. So you're fighting this. So I was a little bit jet lagged, and I came from Sri Lanka. So I had this sleepiness coming on, and I was struggling with it. I was having a huge conflict with trying to keep awake. And then all these stories came up. I am Bhanteji's best student, and I sit in front of him. Now what others going to think about me? And I am Dhammaruan. And I'm coming from Sri Lanka, I have a culture, I am born as a Buddhist, so I should sit like this, I shouldn't fall asleep. But what happens? Each time I think, I struggle, I fall more sleepy. So finally, I tried everything in the book, and finally I thought, never mind, I'm going to open my eyes. So with lot of shame, I opened my eyes, and Bhante was just in front of me. And he was sleeping away. He didn't care. Because he came from America. He was even more jet lagged than me. The problem was with me was I was struggling. I was having this conflict. So he didn't have a conflict. So immediately when you let go, the conflict stops. And the way to stop this conflict, the key is mindfulness. And going back to mindfulness, talking about mindfulness, mind has a nature. We don't need mindfulness is not something external that we have to learn. Mind naturally falls into mindfulness. We don't need to, it doesn't belong to a particular culture, particular religion, naturally falls into mindfulness. You keep a, if everybody leaves this place, if I'm just sitting here, I have nothing to do, I'll be still. Everyone has this capacity to come to stillness and come to mindfulness. So, it says, the board says, conflict resolving with mindfulness. So, there's one word, although it's not mentioned there, it is meant. That is right mindfulness. So, can you tell me, is there something called wrong mindfulness? Isn't mindfulness mindfulness? I mean, mindfulness is mindfulness, isn't it? So, is there something called wrong mindfulness? Can you have intent? What determines that? So there was in my teacher training, there was a teacher, a good friend of mine, and we had a little bit of an argument because he said there is nothing called wrong mindfulness. And I said, of course there is wrong mindfulness. And Buddha talks about this wrong mindfulness. So the bhikkhus might know this. 5 minutes already. Five minutes left. Okay, I had to talk about my past life then. Of course, you can ask questions about it later on, right? So, just I wanted to let you know that there is right mindfulness, and right mindfulness is, what is the right mindfulness? It's the four foundations of mindfulness, or meditating on meditation is what you meant by mindfulness here. Meditation. How to resolve conflict with meditation. Four foundations of mindfulness. Meditation is understanding who you are. Four foundations of mindfulness is understanding who you are. Your mind, your body, your feelings, the nature of awareness, the consciousness, mind objects. So this is understanding who you are. And past life, the connection is, past life is also part of that understanding. So when you, you cannot believe past lives. It's a meditation development. It's a spiritual development. Some of you may believe it because you have samsaric potential. You have done the practice before. It can never be convinced to another. However, if you are Swami at 3 years old, 4 years old, chanting this, you will not believe because it's a meditative development. So I just want to tell that. And the story, I think at this rate, I would need about half an hour to talk about at least, but 4 minutes, I know. So, That child was me, and I was, I chanted these sutras spontaneously. When it started, first day, my mother thought it was not a good thing, so she closed my mouth when I started chanting, because I chanted not only Pali, some other languages as well in the beginning. But later on, I was adopted, and they came to find out one day when everybody was away, and there was one lady at the home, and then I started spontaneously chanting the first one from Dhamma Chakka Sutta, Chakku Karani, Jnana Karani, Upasamaya Abhinyaya, Sambuddhaya Nibbanaya Sangvatati. So that those are the first words I told. Thereafter, a lot of people came and recorded and took the records away. And finally, my foster father thought he should invest on a tape recorder. So after many years later, about 2 years later, he got a tape recorder. So I've chanted from that age till about 6, 7, 8, around that time. How I came to know these things is when I was, one of my past lives was at the time of, in the 5th century, there was a monk called Venerable Buddha Ghosa. Does anyone know him? Venerable Buddha Ghosa? He's the one who wrote the Visuddhi Magga, Path of Purification. Actually, we wrote it, right? So I came with him from India to Sri Lanka, and I was one of the people who memorized sutras, because at that time there was no books to carry. So we had people, several monks, so I was one of the monks who has memorized these things. And whenever we do some studies, I was like a disc or something like that. So spontaneously the disc started playing this lifetime. So that's what happened. So also I went in for meditation. Only after meditation I started. There's a lot of things to talk about if I want to tell. But I think time is 1 minute. Then there's another life, actually, that is, I've had several lifetimes, I recall several lifetimes. One is, the most powerful one is this one, as well as then I had simultaneously other lifetimes coming where I had I was a family man, and there are similarities of that family life and the family life I'm leading now, and that Dhamma life and the Dhamma life I'm leading right now. So there is this similarity. I'm just telling you this because whatever your life is right now could have a connection to your next life and the life before. So you have to be careful with that, whatever you do. So that's why I want to tell you that. So I have been always going from this monk life and then this family life. So I think that's in time's up. What to do?
Thank you very much, Dhammarohan. And perhaps there'll be questions from the floor which will give you more time to share more of your past lives. So the next gentleman who is going to be coming to speak was once upon a time president of the Buddhist Society of Western Australia. And he's also a hypnotist and a regression therapist. So those of you who haven't figured out what your past life was, perhaps he can help you. And he draws on this practice to help others prepare their minds with emptiness and stillness to provide a gateway for the deep subconscious mind to access events that may be causing them trouble or trauma. The clarity and insight that comes from this technique can bring about catharsis, healing, and life-changing results. And I have to admit, I have tried regression therapy. So now, please welcome Dennis Shepherd.
You can hear me okay? No? Okay, how's that? You can hear me? Yes, yes, it's good. Good joke. Thank you, Jake. Well, just to start off, first of all, could I have a volunteer who would like to be turned into a chicken? Ajahn Brahm? See, Ajahn Brahm will do this kind of stuff without being hypnotised anyway, so it doesn't matter. No, I'm only messing with your mind. I'm not going to be doing any hypnosis on the stage here today, but I am definitely going to try and explain to you just what this process is and just explain a little bit to you about what I've been doing over the last 10 years or so since I've had the good fortune to learn this process of hypnosis from some very generous people that have taught me, and also the generosity of all the clients that I've had to teach, because it's, you know, as some of the other speakers have said, it's all very well standing here and thinking you've got all this knowledge, but actually I've been taught by the clients that I've had. And some of those clients have been very successful, and I can tell you right up to some of them have been absolute failures. So it runs the whole gauntlet. But I think that I'm in a good position to speak about this because of the meditation practice that I've done over the years, just practicing and understanding a little bit about what meditation is and how it works. Because hypnosis and meditation, I suppose they are similar in a way, but hypnosis is all about dissociation. So what the hypnotist is trying to do with your mind is to sort of separate the conscious from the subconscious, or make that split that we all can do very readily like that. Now, on the other hand, so we've got the hypnosis and dissociation. On the other hand, meditation, I see, is a unification. When we meditate, when we sit, make our minds mindfulness, we are actually in a process of unifying our mind. So this dissociation practice that we do, a hypnotist will use usually three tricks to distract the mind so that we can get to the subconscious. And maybe Jake might just show us the first slide. I've just got a slide of an iceberg that will come up just to illustrate the difference between consciousness and subconsciousness. The tip of the iceberg is really what we see as consciousness, as a conscious mind. Underneath is subconscious, and that's really how it is for most of us. We've got all this subconscious stuff that happens to us, and it pushes us around. It's really the most powerful thing in our lives, in a way. But most of the time we don't even see it. It's just not there. But the conscious part is up the top, and it's kind of keeping everything locked. But when you go to sleep at night, of course, you know that you've got a subconscious mind. You start dreaming, and there's all sorts of things that happen to you like that. But where I want or perhaps just before I go, and I'll just explain the way that we use hypnosis to get to that subconscious part. The hypnotist will use either a technique of boring, so just rattling on and on and on and on to a client until they just more or less fade away, go to sleep, and then the subconscious mind is accessible. You can use a shock tactic, or quite often in my practice I use a confusion technique, so just confusing the mind, and then you can sort of get into the subconscious part underneath. And to do this, you know, it can be quite traumatic, actually, sometimes when people access what they've got there in their subconscious mind, and this is really where all the past lives usually live. So I would just like to just explain how I got to the technique that I use, which I think is a good one. It's a good one for me anyway. I know that other people might have other ways of doing this, but I spent many years with the Samaritans, and they were so really good to me to be able to teach you how to listen, just listening. And even Ajahn Brahm will talk often about, you know, just the importance of being able to listen. Even just listening to yourself is really what we're doing with this mindfulness, listening internally just to see what's going on in our mind. But I used to work at the Samaritans where we'd have a lot of suicidal people call in, and over the years, there's actually 22, 3 years that I spent there on the phones listening to to suicidal people. And oftentimes the people would come there, you know, they would ring there, they'd be really ringing as the last, it's the last chance. They'd probably be all through the doctors, they've been through the system, they know more about suicide than what's, and what's available for it than really most other people. So this listening became very important, just the ability to be able to listen closely to someone. And it's a very powerful therapy, just to listen to someone. And you have to ask yourself, you know, how often do we listen to each other really? It's quite a skill just to be able to listen to, and listen to somebody else. And when you're being listened to, you know, don't you? You know that you're being listened to. Because it's like an act of love in a way when someone really listens to you properly. So I was looking for a method that sort of employed this kind of practice. And just as I've been to learn hypnosis from a very generous man who taught me many of the techniques. But then one day my wife, Heidi, just sort of spontaneously booked me into this session with a lady called Dolores Cannon. Now, if I had known about Dolores Cannon before she booked me in, I wouldn't have gone, because she certainly had some strange ideas. She's a wonderful woman. She actually died 2 or 3 years ago. And when I was learning from her, of course, she was nearly to her 80s then, so 70s to 80s. But she wrote all the books about conversations with Nostradamus and things like that. So there were some very, what I thought at the time, very strange things that she was teaching. But at any rate, learning from her, she taught me this technique of, first of all, asking somebody a question. You know, what would you like to find out about your hypnosis? What, with the hypnosis session, what would you like to take out of it? And then once you get that question, then you put the people into a trance, and then just using metaphors. It's basically just the process of using metaphors. You get them to tell a story about the question or questions that they want to understand. So that's all right. Usually you do get a story, and sometimes the stories come out and I'm kind of bemused. I don't really know what they mean. But then the third part of her process, though, is using the subconscious mind itself of the client to be able to explain what that story is. So while they're still in a trance, you take them down a little deeper into the trance and then get them to explain what the story means. And it's quite astonishing sometimes just to hear what they say about that story. So this is the basic technique that I use. I think it's a very gentle technique. It's a technique that's not intrusive. I stay right out of the conversation, my own emotional noise, to the extent that I can keep it out. I keep it out so that it just stays with the person and the issue that they're trying to look at. So that's a little bit about the method that I use. Now, I wanted to just move on quickly, because I know time runs so fast here, just into the way, because as some of you probably know, I've had some quite successful past life regressions from people, and they run from people that believe what they're saying. Just as Dharma, it was very, very nice to hear what Dharma Ruwan was saying there, just saying that you could never really believe a past life, because I really don't know what a belief is anyway, and I think in Buddhism that we find that an open question anyway, isn't it? Because there's no, in Buddhism we don't really have a belief system as such like that. It's more, there's certainly no dogma anyway attached to it. It is understanding yourself. And so the believability part is really quite interesting. And I wanted to just share with you a couple of stories about that. Because I had one client, I'm going to be very careful not to sort of try and identify them in any way, because there are several people in the audience here that have seen me. So I don't want to in any way cause anyone any embarrassment. But one client came and went quite easily into a trance, telling me a story, and it was quite a lurid story, and it was, to me, it was one of the type things that he was saying. I could really see how it related to what he came about, what the question was that he came about. But as he was kind of talking to me, there was his conscious mind kept on coming back into the picture, and it's like, this is bullshit! This is bullshit! You know, it's, I'm saying, don't worry about that, just tell me, but it's bullshit! And I'm saying, well, just humour me, tell me what you're seeing in your subconscious. So he continued on telling me what he's seeing in the subconscious mind. And even when we finished the whole session, you know, he still was very doubtful about the whole episode, but what he told me was very, very interesting. Because this man was a meditator. He was quite a good meditator. And he said, the strange thing about all of that, he said, I had a nimitta there the whole time. Now, I don't know if everyone in the audience knows what a nimitta is, but a nimitta is, that's an instability in the mind that really is giving you an indication that you're very, very close to the present moment. The mind's becoming very still. It's becoming quite unstable. But it's very close to the present moment. You might say very close to truth. So that's just one example there of just really how hard it is sometimes to believe these things. Now, another example that I've had, though, just to talking about things that you can believe more fully, is another client that I had who can maybe just tell you a little bit about the lead-up to this story. He opened the session by feeling buttons on a coat, and it was a red coat. And I'm thinking, oh, yeah, this man's somewhere in America or perhaps in England, red coat guard. As it turned out, it wasn't. It was in Barracks Square, Barracks Arch, in Perth, before the whole thing was pulled down, of course, in the mid-1800s. Anyway, this man went on to explain many, many things about that life. He was able to identify his name, his wife's name, his children's names, and because he's a man of I would say reasonably high intellect and can do, you know, he can do things, and he was able to go to the Batty Library, and his story, as it was kind of related to me, just really fell out of the record like a stone. In fact, we did subsequent work together where we were able to sort of discover many more things about his life. Now, I might say that this sort of, for this man, I think I'd be right in saying that it, for a while, caused him some, well, you might say, discombobulation. It was probably very good that he had our centre, perhaps myself as a reference point, but being able to just stabilise himself and sort of work through the process of just what that means. And I think that now from this point looking back, I would say that he's very much better for the experience of doing that hypnosis and seeing that past life. So that's just a little bit about the believability of it, but the thing that I was going to say too about the way that when you're doing these sessions with somebody, oftentimes there can be just a story running, and because, you know, especially with hypnosis, I mean, I could hypnotise someone and tell them to do something, and if they come back in and sort of believe what I've said, but then you say, oh no, but just because I've just done that, the person will confabulate. No, you'll confabulate a story. So you know that these confabulations happen. But oftentimes I'm sitting in my chair and the person's sitting there, they're running through what their story about their life. You know, oh yes, I'm walking down a grass path, yes, and there's maybe a rock up there, you know, and you can just see the person's just, it's an intellectual exercise. They're just intellectualising the process of doing it. But then walking down this path, this rock, and then all of a sudden they go, and there's this emotional sort of yelp or cry or, I've been shot, I've been stabbed, you know, and you can see that they're feeling the wound, they're feeling the whole thing. And what this shows me in this process of meditation is that there's a congruency that's needed to get to the truth of it. When the head and the heart come together and there's congruency, then you know that the truth is fairly near. And I think that that head and heart thing is really something that happens for humanity anyway. And it's something that really needs to happen. I think even in our meditation practice, I've sort of noticed that myself. When the head and the heart are congruent, then, and this is the emotions and the intellect, when that's congruent, then you're able to go much deeper with your meditation practice. I didn't have much more to say to you about that, but I know that my time's up, so I'll leave it at that, and we'll see what happens with the questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dennis. So anyone asleep? If you did, that was hypnosis by confusion. When he did that heart shot thing, I thought it was going to fall on me. So now we have Professor Bernard Carr, who shares a history with Ajahn Brahm because they went to university together in Cambridge. And he's the professor of mathematics and astronomy for his doctorate, which he obtained in 1976. So they're both about the same age. He studied relativity and cosmology under Stephen Hawking at the Institute of Astronomy in Cambridge and the California Institute of Technology. His interests outside physics include psychic research, and they were both in the Psychic Research Society. And those of you who may not have known, Bernard Carr was also the treasurer of the Buddhist Society in Cambridge University, who was trying to turn Ajahn Brahm away from joining the society. When Ajahn Brahm wanted to join, he said, no, you really should come first to check it out. And he was the treasurer. So he was almost going to deprive the Buddhist Society of a £1 membership fee as well. And Professor Bernard Carr is also the chair of the Scientific and Medical Network in the UK and a co-holder of a grant from the John Templeton Foundation for a project entitled Fundamental Physics and the Problem of Existence. He's the editor of a book based on a series of conferences funded by the foundation entitled Universe or Multiverse. And he's also made an appearance in the documentary film The Trouble with Atheism. So now let's welcome him to the stage, Professor Bernard Carr.
Thank you, Angie. And first of all, I should say that I prefer to think that I recruited a John to the Cambridge Buddhist Society, but I was using the subtle psychology of pretending not to. So I hope my talk now will appear, my picture should appear on the screen. The title I've given myself is Past Lives and Rebirth of Science. And I should say that I'm actually originally was planning to talk about just reincarnation and psychical research. But I decided I wanted to expand to a broader theme about the relationship between science and Buddhism, because I somehow feel that's what people seem to be interested in my private conversations. And after all, the title of this whole meeting is Resolving Conflict with Mindfulness. And actually, what really interests me is the conflict between science and spirituality. And Buddhism, of course, is one aspect of spirituality. Because historically, of course, there is a conflict between these two areas. But my message is always that actually they are not in conflict, but they are brought together. And of course, what does bring them together is mind. Science is essentially a mental activity, understanding the world, and spirituality also involves mind. Mind being, of course, a very broad term. And in particular, I'm going to talk about psychic phenomena. And psychic phenomena are interesting because one is trying to study them scientifically, but what you're studying is also linked to spiritual experiences. And so in that sense, psychic phenomena provide a sort of bridge between science and spirituality. And I've been always interested in being on that bridge. But I have to warn you that, that being on that bridge is rather uncomfortable. It always is. Because if you study psychic phenomena, the scientists think you're too mystical and the mystics think you're too scientific. So it's not a particularly pleasant place to be. But I am enjoying this weekend. My profession is cosmology, and I, as a scientist, and I thought I would start off by giving you like a 1 minute tour of the history of physics, our understanding of the physical universe. That's the science on the left side. Now, this is my favorite symbol. This is the cosmic Ouroboros. It's the snake that swallows its own tail. And basically, around the body of the snake, you can see all the different scales of structure in the universe. So you have people at the bottom. As you go to the right, you've got mountains and planets and stars and solar systems and galaxies and the universe. Bigger and bigger things. As you go to the left, you have smaller and smaller things like ants and amoebas and DNA and atoms and nuclei of atoms and things like that. So it's like a clock, whereas you, for every minute the scale gets bigger and bigger as you go in the anti-clockwise direction. So let me give you a 1 minute tour of the history of physics, of how we've come to understand the universe. Physics or science is really expanding our awareness to ever larger and smaller scales by using telescopes and microscopes and things. So, let's go over the outward journey. We started off, of course, with the geocentric view, where the Earth is the center of the world. Then we evolved to the heliocentric view, where we realized that the Sun was the center of the universe. And then we eventually realized, about the beginning of this last, the 20th century, that to the galactocentric view, where the galaxy is the center of the universe. And then we soon realized that actually there are billions of galaxies, and we had the cosmocentric view. And that's the modern view of cosmology. But actually, nowadays, we think our universe is just one of many universes. And this is the multiverse. In fact, that's the book which Andrew referred to. So this is representing the history of, say, a few thousand years. Now let's take the inward journey to smaller scales. We discovered atoms. We discovered the nuclei, which are at the center of atoms and associated, of course, with nuclear energy and atom bombs and things. The standard model of physics has just been verified a few years ago with the discovery of the Higgs particle, sometimes called the God particle. And then we know that there are other areas of physics to be probed by Large Hadron Collider. And our final theory is M theory, which is supposed to be the final theory of the universe. And to me, this symbol is a very powerful symbol because it represents the triumph of physics in coming to understand the whole physical universe from the very largest to the very smallest scales. And incidentally, the reason the snake swallows its own head is because, sorry, its own tail, is because that represents the Big Bang. At the Big Bang, the very large merges with the very small. The technical reasons, which I can explain later if you like. So this is a great triumph. On the other hand, it's a bit worrying, because what you realize is that we, having started off at the center of the universe, are actually now completely insignificant. This is a Peanuts cartoon. You are of no importance, did you know that? You're only the tiniest speck in an enormous universe. Then I might as well go back to universe, to sleep. Because we are completely insignificant as judged by scale. And in fact, Steven Weinberg says the more the universe seems comprehensible, the more it seems pointless. And it's clear what's wrong. What's wrong is that wonderful picture of physics, which serves us so well, makes no reference to mind. In fact, you'll find most physicists try and push mind out of the picture altogether. It's not regarded as part of physics. So actually, this is the triumph of mindlessness as opposed to mindfulness. And that can't be right. And so what I want to argue is that mind is a fundamental and not an incidental feature of the universe. And actually, this must be true because I noticed it's on a sign as you go into the coffee room. Part of the, somebody put up this quote for some reason. But anyway, that's the view I hold very strongly. Now, mainstream science, let me just say, first of all, to complete the mainstream science view, matter is the only reality. This is what's called materialism. Everything is explained by physics, so everything, including what's going on in your head, is explained by local interactions between little bits of matter obeying known laws. That's called reductionism. Consciousness, with which you're hopefully focusing on this talk, is just generated by the brain. It's the excretion of the brain, and then when when our brains die, we die. There can be no survival of death. We are just biological machines. Essentially, we are zombies. Religion, spirituality, mystical insights, they are all illusions. Now, this isn't my view, but this is the view of mainstream science, almost. Some large fraction of scientists. But this isn't science. This is what is called scientism. Okay? It's an extreme view of science, which says that matter is all that counts. And it's not the main view of the population of the world, but of certain extreme scientists. And what we need is a middle way between the fundamentalisms of religion and science. I'm interested in religion, but I tend to be negative about fundamentalist religion. And this view of scientism is essentially a fundamentalist form of science, which should be avoided. Now, that's where psychical research comes in. Because psychical research shows that the standard view of consciousness in the brain cannot be correct. I'm going to say a bit about what psychical research studies. I assume most of you are familiar with these terms, but I thought it would be useful just to give you an overview. It's the scientific study of the unexplained interactions between minds and between minds and matter. And the crucial point there is it's scientific. It is aiming to use scientific methodology to study these phenomena. But they are unexplained. And because of that, mainstream science, by and large, doesn't believe in the phenomena that I'm going to tell you about. Telepathy. Direct communication between minds. Clairvoyance. The ability of my mind to see what's going on outside this room, even though I can't use my normal physical senses. Precognition. My ability, I have to be careful, when I say my ability, I'm not claiming these personally, but the reported ability, to foresee what's going to happen if I overrun on my talk, for example. Psychokinesis, the ability to affect matter, bend spoons. Levitation, the ability to levitate, which I won't do now. Poltergeist, unexplained physical effects. And these are more experiential things, apparitions, ghosts, near-death experiences, people who nearly die but are resuscitated and they go through the tunnel and they see the being of light and things like that. Out-of-body experiences, where people, your consciousness seems to leave your body and float around the room and to other exotic places. If I may, I'll tell a little story about a yarn here, because when I was at Cambridge, one of the first experiments I tried to do was to weigh the soul. And I did this because the idea was that when you sleep and your astral body leaves your physical body, and when you wake up it comes back again. So the theory was your weight should go down if your soul has any weight. Now, I was asked to, on Friday evening, I was asked to reveal some of the dark secrets of the unwitting. One of my subjects in that experiment was, in fact, John. I weighed his soul while he was actually asleep, I presume, and I have to say, John's soul has no weight. Well, or maybe he has no soul, but maybe that's... I guess that's an answer, yeah. But anyway, Seriously, what these experiences suggest, they suggest that consciousness, if it's true, can exist independent of the brain. Because the brain should, I mean, near-death experiences, out-of-body experiences shouldn't be possible, according to the normal reductionist view. It means you need a different theory of mind, which is sometimes called the filter theory of mind, which says our consciousness exists and merely perceives the world through the brain, rather than being generated by the brain. And it opens up the possibility of survival. But the point about psychic phenomena is that they imply a direct interaction between our minds and the physical world. And therefore, that has to relate to physics, if you believe in physics. If I'm able to levitate Angie by looking at her, I'm interacting with a physical system, and that needs a physical explanation. But I won't do it. Now, I'm talking about the relationship between religion and science. And actually, religion helps science in different ways. For example, one of the remarkable things in Buddhism, for example, is that through meditation and spiritual development, you can obtain clairvoyant knowledge of the physical universe. And indeed, it's recorded in the suttas and the Visuddhimagga that Buddha and his disciples themselves obtained clairvoyant insights into the nature of the physical universe. That diagram I showed you right at the beginning, the Ouroboros, about the large and small scales of structure, many features of that appear to have been revealed actually in the suttas. I can't go into the details, but I had some fascinating discussions at Jhana Grove with the monks about that. And of course, the idea that you can sit in meditation and find out all these things about the secrets of the physical universe on the largest or smaller scales would be met with incredulity by mainstream science. I mean, here they are spending billions of dollars on the International Space Station to probe the edge of the universe, and here is the claim that we can use our inner space station, our meditation, to get the same information. But now, how does science help religion? That was an example of how religion, Buddhism in particular, was giving scientific insights. And I just want to focus on what's supposed to be my main theme, which is reincarnation studies. Now, I don't have a great deal of time to talk about this, but I just want to say the key person in this field is Ian Stevenson. He's died now, but he, since the 1960s, he devoted his life to studying children who had memories of their previous lives. And so there are many ways of discussing reincarnation through experience, through meditation, or through hypnotic regression. But I'm focusing on this particular approach, which is the evidence which comes from studying young children. So here is Ian Stevenson. Here is some of his books. His successor was called Jim Tucker, and he's also read some books. And if you want more information, you can look at those books. But the most convincing evidence from a scientific point of view comes from children who recall and details of their previous lives. And furthermore, those details are subsequently confirmed. And a little cartoon here, a little joke. I don't know if I can make... Well, no, I can crack jokes. Adan is always cracking jokes. Okay. This is a little boy sitting next to his father. Yeah, well, I didn't believe in reincarnation when I was your age either. Yeah. Mm. Now, what are the important features? I was warned by Angie not to use too many words in my presentation. But I'm going to get into trouble here, but however, that's what professors do. So let me briefly summarize the important features. Sometimes dying persons actually want to be reborn and announce this in the dream to the mother. So that happens on occasions. The mother, before she gives birth, will receive a message about that. But most of these cases involve children who start talking about their previous life when they're very young, about 3 years old. I'm not sure how this relates to your experience. I'd be interested to hear. But it stops at about 6 years. So they forget their memories at about six. They start at three when they start talking, but they forget by the age of six. Usually it's a recent life. Maybe the typical interval is something like 16 months. Most of the memories are associated with the end of life, and in fact 75% describe actually how they died. Normally death is unnatural. Their life comes to an end because they're murdered or they have an accident. It's not the people who die in a nice, comfortable way who have these experiences. It seems to the people who die come to an abrupt end. Or if they do die naturally, it's prematurely when they're very young. Normally the previous lives are very ordinary. They weren't Cleopatra or Julius Caesar or anything like this. And nearly always they come from nearby regions, I mean in the same country. The point being that if somebody says they were Cleopatra or Julius Caesar, you're more likely to put it down to fantasy, I guess. Many of the children show phobias associated with their previous death. So if they drowned, they're afraid of water. If they were shot, they're afraid of guns. And sometimes philias, if they loved alcohol in their previous life, they might like it here. Or talents, precocious talents, such as being able to recite the sutras might be an example of that. The really interesting thing is that 35% of these children have birthmarks associated with the way in which they died. So now I'm just going to end with some examples of this, because to me this is what Stevenson spent 20 years looking at, because it's sort of physical evidence. And the claim is that post-mortem, people have odd birthmarks, and then he finds that the people who died have wounds corresponding to the birthmarks. And they're close, in most cases, they're very close to where they were actually on the previous body. And that comes from the post-mortem report. I'm just going to end with a few examples. So here's an example of somebody who has scars on his chest, a macula on chest of an Indian youth who as a child remembered the life of Raja Ram, killed with a shotgun fired at close range. And you can see that's the actual photograph of his chest, and this is the picture of on the post-mortem report. Here is somebody born with a malformed ear, and a Turkish boy who remembered the life of a man fatally wounded on the right side of the head by a shotgun discharge at close range. So the idea is, the person dies with this injury, he's reborn, and he remembers being killed, and he has a physical wound corresponding to it. Another case, almost absent fingers on one hand in a boy of India who remembered the life of a boy of another village who had put his hand into the blade of a fodder chopping machine and had the fingers amputated. And you can see, of course, he's born without fingers. Congenital absence of a lower leg in a Burmese girl who remembered the life of a young woman accidentally run over by a train with a right leg being severed first. Epidermal nerve nevus on the head of a Thai man who as a child remembered the life of his paternal uncle, killed with a blow on the head from heavy knife. And here's another case. Some of these involve two birthmarks. If you're shot, the bullet goes in one place and comes out another place. So there are two injuries. In this case, he has two injuries. Small round puckered birthmark on the boy corresponding to the entry wound in the man whose life he remembered who had been shot with a rifle from behind. And then on the front, large irregularly shaped birthmark in the frontal area. This birthmark corresponded to the exit bullet wound of the man whose life he remembered. Now to me, from a scientific perspective, this evidence is remarkable. If you have a meditation experience to remember your past life, it may well be true, but it doesn't carry the same scientific weight. This to me is the evidence that something's going on. Reincarnation is a complicated concept, but something's going on which can't be explained by the standard picture. To me, this is the evidence that the standard view that mind and consciousness are just produced by the brain cannot be correct. I just want to end on a rather personal tone. I started off talking about the link between science and spirituality and how Psi plays a key role in that link, and I'd like to just finish off by really paying tribute to John, because he's my friend for 45 years, and we both started off in Cambridge. We were interested in science and psychical research and spirituality. Our lives have gone in different ways, and I just wanted to sort of show our timelines. There we are. Sounds a bit egocentric. I'm sorry talking about myself, but it's just to make a point. And Then I went into cosmology. I went into cosmology and did my PhD under Stephen Hawking. So he sort of became my guru, and he wasn't so famous in those days, but he was still a very brilliant guy, and I was very lucky to have him as my teacher. Ajahn, of course, went to study under Ajahn Chah and was his guru. And so we went in our different directions, but I know we both kept up interests, but this was the focus of our lives. We went on our merry ways. I became a professor in 1985. Ajahn, it might have been 83, I think, but anyway, round about then, he was the abbot, and he found the monastery, of course, and then we carried on our in our different paths, but all being in contact. And now, in 2015, we've come together again in Perth. And to me, that path is significant because it represents the connection between science and spirituality. So even though we go on our separate ways, we come together, and indeed, this is just a microcosm, I believe, of what will happen between science and spirituality as a whole. The temporary division between science and spirituality, I feel one day we will be rejoined, not just as individuals, but as areas of knowledge. And so by Perth, this is my little image, really, of reminds me of the place where the image has gone from the screen now, but it doesn't matter. So there it is. That's my image for this meeting. So thank you. So I want to thank John for inviting me here and for the 45 years of friendship and everyone here for a wonderful talk. Thank you. A wonderful meeting.
Thank you, Bernard, for mapping the 46 years of your journey together. And obviously, it's pretty hard for you to call him Ajahn because you've always called him Pete. So I always notice that hesitation, Ajahn, and sometimes it comes out as John. Thank you for that life-blowing presentation. So let's give Bernard another round of applause, please. I'm still looking for the person that boxed me in the right eye before I died because I was born with a green birthmark on my right eye. And so whenever I wear makeup, I always put green makeup on the left eye. So in any time you wonder why I put such heavy makeup when I do put makeup, that's to balance it. But thankfully, it's on the eye and not on my cheek or anywhere else, which would look rather odd. So now we're going to have Q&A session, but just to make sure that, you know, nothing runs quite predictably, we have Ajahn Brahm, who is going to be chairing or moderating or even doing the Q&A session instead. So I'm not sure how it's going to turn out, but over to Ajahn Brahm.
Okay, stereo. First of all, Bernard, my good friend from Cambridge many years ago, he told a little anecdote which I would ask him to share with everybody here, because one of the problems is proving to the skeptical person that such psychic phenomena actually exists. Even though I've known Dhammaruan for a long time, I was very convinced the first time I heard that chanting, simply because as a Buddhist monk, I know that chanting was accurate. And there's few Buddhist monks, even my Sangha sitting there, can chant accurately like that after so many years of being a monk. And he could do that as a kid. And that was just so convincing to me. And of course, having known Dennis for such a long time, and that all those years I've known him, he is straight up, straight down, very honest. So what he says, and I can believe, I have no doubt about what he says, and obviously Bernard as well, being a good friend, I know that whatever he says, I can take for granted as truth. But it's so difficult to convince other people, and I want him to to share with you what he shared with me about an experiment which was done in Imperial College. So, Bernard, can you tell us about the experiment which was done in Imperial College in London University?
The point of this experiment was to show that people see what they want to see, or what they believe is going to happen. And John referred to the fact that skeptics will not accept any of these so-called psychic phenomena, because they don't seem to fit in with their standard view of physics. The story was this. A friend of mine called Arthur Ellison, he had a meeting at Imperial College, and during the meeting, he had a vase of flowers up there at the front. And as an experiment, he said they were going to levitate. He was going to ask the audience to levitate a vase of flowers. We could almost do it now, but I won't because we're short of time. and the idea, but he, it was important, of course, that people had to get into the right frame of mind. So he asked people to sort of chant and hum in some way to get into the right state of mind. And they had to focus on the vase of flowers and will it to levitate while they were chanting. Sure enough, after about 5 minutes, the vase started levitating, apparently due to the pure mental intention of the audience. Now, unknown to the audience, this was not a psychic phenomenon. There was, in fact, an electromagnet, and it was being levitated electromagnetically. So it was a natural phenomenon. And the reason people had to chant was because they wanted to hide the noise of the electromagnet. You mustn't infer from this that every time the monks chant that they're trying to hide the noise of an electromagnet. But the interesting thing was, Arthur Ellison asked people afterwards what experiences they had. And of course, people saw it levitate. Some people saw spirit hands levitating it, but most people saw it levitate. But there were also some skeptics in the audience who knew this couldn't happen, that mind couldn't levitate. And the skeptics actually were interviewed and said, no, it did not levitate. They could not see it levitating, even though it wasn't really a psychic phenomena. And that was a very insightful experiment, because it actually showed that people won't see what they don't want to see, or what they're not used to seeing. It's the same idea that when the natives in the jungle first see the aeroplane, they don't know what it, they can't see it because they don't know what it is. And that's part of the reason, I think, that many scientists are so skeptical about these experiences. They haven't actually had the experiences, and they think, misconceivably, that it doesn't fit in with their laws of physics. I don't think that's right at all. I think there are expanded laws of physics which would allow these things, but basically they don't have these experiences, so they think they can't be true. Anyway, but thank you for reminding me of that.
Okay, so now we can have some questions to our panel. Again, we do have the microphones here, so please go up to the microphones. Or if you wish to send your question to one of the panel psychically, please focus the mind and the panel will answer appropriately. So we have a question, I think, from Lawrence. Is you there? Yes. Lawrence, first of all, over here.
Hi, my name is Diana.
Oh, not Lawrence. No, Lawrence behind, please. Lawrence. Because Diana, you've answered
the question.
Lawrence at the back. Hello, Lawrence. Okay, I think you have to come down, I think, because that one is not working.
Can I be
asked? Sure. Lawrence, see you first. Okay, maybe Lawrence can come down, first of all. So, Venerable Buddhaka Tamis, let Lawrence come through. Very good.
My question is to you, Ajahn. Could you give us a description of how insight into rebirth arises within a meditative context to do with jhana? And
okay, well, I can do that without breaking my rules. In the deep meditations, one of the things which you recognize with mindfulness and very, very clear awareness is your five external senses disappear. So you literally cannot hear anything, you can't feel anything with your body, and you go to the sixth sense, the realm of the mind. And that is such a still place, and such a beautiful place, that any other sounds, and sometimes there's very loud sounds happen outside. Sometimes the people come and go. Sometimes even the temperature changes if you sit there long enough. You don't feel anything at all. And what that's actually telling you is those five external senses have been turned off. And with it, turns off the brain as well. And of course, sometimes we like to have some evidence of that. And I think I shared with you before that one of our members years ago got into such a deep state of meditation when he was at home here in Perth. His wife thought he had died, called the ambulance. They put him in the back of the ambulance because there was no discernible pulse. And these were trained medics. And so they put him in the back of the ambulance with the sirens going, do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do, going through all the red lights, there's an emergency, getting him into the hospital, straight into the triage area, putting an ECG on his brain. It was a flat lie. And so ECG on the heart, flat line, EEG, flat line, he was flat lining. And the wife thought he died. She was going crazy. And the doctor thought he died as well. And they put defibrillators on his chest. Bang! Bang! Many times. He rose up above the bed. Many times. They tried to resuscitate him. Flat line. He had died. But he told me afterwards that he was just meditating. He was having the most wonderful time of his life. And he told me he just decided to come out of meditation. And when he made that decision, he came out, he opened his eyes. Beep, beep, beep. Both monitors were perfect. He bent up, he looked around. I was in my bedroom at home. What am I doing here? And his wife explained exactly what happened to him. And he found it was amazing because all the time he was perfectly mindful, very alert, no brain activity at all. And number one, that was showing what you experience yourself. That in these deep states of meditation, you die. In the sense that your body stops. And if somebody came to test you, they would think you were dead. But an important point, and this is something which you see in the sutras, the difference is that if you are meditating deeply and your heart has stopped and your brain is not working, your body is still warm. But if you die dead, your body is cold. And the doctor noticed that. That's one of the reasons he kept on trying to defibrillate this fellow. Because his body was warm, which was an oddity for him. And he came out afterwards, and I interrogated him afterwards when he told the story. He said, what was it like being like that? He said, so pleasant, so wonderful. Was there anything unpleasant about it? I asked him. He said, yes, there was. The scolding he got from his wife on the way home. Don't you ever do that again. She was so upset. Now you know this, that at this time, the five senses stopping is similar to a death. So what it actually proves to you, because you do this yourself, is that this mind, I'm not saying the brain, the mind, still carries on working when the brain has stopped. The mind is still very much alert and alive. So anyone who gets into that deep state of meditation will know for sure that the mind is independent of the body and the brain. So when the body and the brain goes, you experience this, the mind carries on. Which gives you direct knowledge of why reincarnation happens. Why that when death happens, you get reborn. So that's something which does come up for many people. And the other thing which comes up for many people is that when you do get to those great states of meditation, again, similar to what you can read in the sutras, they say, and it's absolutely true, your mind becomes malleable. Now, you can actually do things with it. And the simile, the only simile which I can come up with, is not really an appropriate simile. It's like having a well-trained dog. And you tell the dog, go and get my slippers, go and get the newspaper, and the dog does it straight away. And in that state of meditation, you can just tell your mind, go and get my past life memory, go and get my slippers. And the mind does that for you.
Or it can just happen spontaneously in the wake of jhana, you're saying?
Yes, spontaneously, or you can just ask for it, and it happens. Very good.
I have a bunch of questions to all speakers. The first one is to my dear friend, Damarwan. I've met you many times in USA and Sri Lanka. You hosted me in Sri Lanka. When I was coming to this conference, I read somewhere that this is the first time you are going to address the public, that this is going to be your last lifetime. I mean, your last life. I read in a literature of the conference that you are going to declare in the public for the first time that this is going to be your last life.
So, Venerable, is that true?
Is that
can
true?
Can you please confirm?
Okay, yes. Okay,
then, first of all, but yes. Let's one at a time, first of all. Can you confirm this now before you actually leave this world?
So, I'm glad you asked that. Because if I say that, I'm indirectly telling that I'm enlightened. So, I have not stated that at all. So it's, what I have said is, this is the first time I am telling about my past life experience openly after 40 odd years. So this is the first time I have never spoken about this to a group of people. So it was kept was kept like a secret. So people knew, a very famous secret, but first time I'm telling people, but not my last life. I never said that.
Thank you very much for clarification. Okay, the other speaker is Dennis Shepherd. Can you please tell us whether all people can be hypnotized, and if not, why?
No, I think that old people certainly can be hypnotized. In fact, I think really off. All people. All people. I beg your pardon. I thought you might have just been ageist there, but well, I think that there are certain people that will resist, and that's always going to happen. But the reality is that we are, as we live, we are all really under the influence of hypnosis anyway. I mean, when you go down to the supermarket and you buy yourself a packet of Kellogg's cornflakes, you may think, yes, I'm going to make the choice of buying that particular brand because I like that brand. But that's just not true at all, because you have been hypnotized. When you're sitting in front of the television, your brain comes down to a nice alpha wave, which is, you know, what happens in when you meditate, nice alpha rhythm in your brain. You're just sitting there relaxed, and you're very open, you're very receptive to a message.
Dennis, I think you better stop before you give away all my secrets of how we get so many donations to this conference.
Okay. To Professor Bernard, thank you very much. All of you, by the way, all the speakers, I really appreciate. Professor Bernard, please, can you tell us, in the beginning, science and spirituality were together under Hippocrates, I think, and what went wrong? Then another question is that I know you are a proponent of psychic phenomena. What do you say about such sciences like neuroscience and quantum physics? Especially for me, quantum physics, when I watch the documentary, is called What the Bleep, seem to be combining science and spirituality. So please, can you say something about whether quantum physics is closer to your thoughts?
Indeed.
Thank you very much.
Your first question about what went wrong. Historically, probably, the key point was when Descartes made this decision, you know, the division between basically because res cogitans and well, basically the matter and mind. And he said that he wanted one side to be the domain of science and one side to be the domain of science. Because remember, in Europe, the Christian church was very powerful. And scientists who disagreed with the Christian church tended to get into trouble, like Galileo and Bruno, who was burnt for his ideas. So in some sense, from a practical point of view, they made a division between the things which science could study and the things which the church or religion could study. And actually, that was very useful. The fact that science was able to focus on a certain set of phenomena, namely the physical material phenomena, and not worry about the internal mental spiritual phenomena was very useful. I mean, the reason science has been so successful is because it's been very narrow-minded. But that is what has brought us all the huge benefits of science, all the technology which we depend on every minute for lighting, the perfect working of our PowerPoint computers. It's all due to science. And so no one can deny the triumph of science. And I started off trying to say that science, it is a wonderful achievement. And it will continue to be a wonderful achievement. However, it is not the whole picture. And what I'm saying is, one should make a distinction between the success of science and the narrow-mindedness of scientism, which says that science and matter is all there is. And I do think that eventually there will be a new paradigm of science which will accommodate mental phenomena and indeed spiritual phenomena. So then you ask the question about the relevance of quantum theory. The point is that one of the indications that consciousness may be relevant to physics does actually come from quantum theory. Because quantum theory is the one place in physics where there is a hint that the observer affects things. In the old classical picture of physics, the observer is more or less irrelevant. The observer is just the passively observes the world, but never actually interacts with it. So when I talked about the mindlessness of modern cosmology, not all scientists deny the existence of mind, but they basically say it's purely passive and that it's not part of the domain of physics. Quantum theory is the one place where you have a hint that maybe consciousness is relevant, because the state of a physical system is dependent upon it is a wave function, and the wave function is fuzzy until someone observes it, and that then collapses the wave function so that the physical system takes on a particular form. In fact, John referred to this on Friday evening when he talked about the elephant collapsing the wave function. Man, I won't go into the details of that, but for those who were there, it was a nice way of putting it. So yes, there is a hint that quantum theory may be relevant to these phenomena. Not all physicists think that consciousness collapsed the wave function, but it's one perfectly respectable way of looking at things. And my own view is that quantum theory alone is not sufficient to explain these phenomena, because it doesn't actually explain consciousness. It merely says consciousness may be relevant to the universe. And no one understands quantum theory either. So you're just explaining one mystery in terms of another mystery. I think we need a deeper picture which explains both of them.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We've only got 5 minutes now, but first of all, this gentleman first and then the lady over there afterwards. So this gentleman first.
Hi, I'm Terry. I'm a local psychologist and have been a student of the parapsychology for a long time. I wanted to ask mainly Bernard Carr about near-death experiences as measured in hospitals, because I know there's an international association that looks at near-death experiences, IANDS, and there's a recent book out by a neurosurgeon, I don't know if you know this one, called Proof of Heaven, The Journey of a Neurosurgeon Through Death. And I was just wondering if you could comment on that. And then my second quick question.
I just have one question because there's another lady.
Oh, okay. Yeah, thanks. Okay.
You can ask the next question in your next life.
Okay.
And if I'm around, then I will try and answer it. But yes, this was a famous book because he was actually a neurosurgeon and he got ill and he was
he, I'm forgetting what was the problem, but he was in a coma for a long time and he had a near-death experience. And it got a lot of publicity. Encephalitis or something like that. But the point is that in all of these cases, the brain seems to be flatlined. And so, as far as you can see, the person has physically died. And I found the story of John told us fascinating, because I was not aware of that. It's not in the literature. But the skeptic will always say, well, how do we know it really flatlined? Because when you measure brain activity, you're only measuring activity on the surface of the brain, and maybe some part deep down is still functioning. We just can't measure it. So it's partly the problem is knowing actually what it means to be dead, because from the medical point of view, what we mean by being dead now is a bit tricky. We can't just say your heart stopped beating. I think we saw a case of somebody who didn't have a heart in yesterday's talk. I mean, but the brain activity is the only way to do it. But as far as we can tell, the brain is not operating. So you would imagine when someone is near the point of death that their minds should be operating less effectively. And yet there are all sorts of examples, not just near-death experiences, where people approaching death, their mind, if anything, becomes clearer. People who are suffering from Alzheimer's and can't remember anything suddenly may become lucid before they die.
In his case, the length of time mattered. He was dead for 6 days, and the experts from all the surrounding hospitals figured he was gone.
Absolutely. I mean, so what the medics were all agreed that he was dead. And that's the key point about this is it means that consciousness cannot just be generated by the brain. Sorry, we can't hear you though if you don't.
Experiences as explained in the book where he went while he was dead.
The point is that when people have these experiences, they go to other realms. They experience other levels of reality. Now, the physical materialist will say that's impossible. The only level of reality is the material level of reality. There's only the one level of reality. Everything else is an illusion. But what you learn, I think, from the spiritual traditions is that's not correct. That there are other levels of reality which are just as real, and they can be shared, they're communal, just like the physical world, but they're simply not on the material level. And I think the new science will have to accommodate that idea.
Okay, can we just take it? Can we just ask this lady over here before she has a near-death experience?
The longest I've stood up for ages. Again, to the cosmologist, I asked myself the question, what was the earliest written human reference to genetic variance or genetic difference or racial differences? And when was the first example of racial prejudice registered? There is the Hindu story of the fair invaders from the north. The answer I got was that 6,000 years ago in Egypt, before the pyramids were built, there were step pyramids called Mastaba or Mastaba. And in hieroglyphics on the walls of one of those buildings is a story of a war between a god of light countenance and a god of dark countenance, who were at war. And the followers of the god of dark countenance were dark countenanced, and the followers of the god of light countenance were light countenanced. And what was the war about? The god of light countenance was the god of the manifest. The god of dark countenance was the god of the unmanifest. And the battle was the god of dark countenance's attempts to prevent the god of light countenance's intention to make manifest something that would bring existence to an ultimate, final, irreversible oblivion.
Well, I have to say that as a cosmologist, this is really outside my level of expertise. A cosmologist claims to be studying the nature of the universe on the larger scales in its entirety, but unfortunately I have no expertise in the area That doesn't mean understanding everything in the universe. I mean, it's the regards that the question of the origin of racial diversity. I mean, even the question of the origin of man, Homo sapiens, is not known, because we tend to get older and older. And, you know, there was a time when it was assumed that conscious man started maybe 6,000 years ago. I mean, you know, that we went through a phase transition where we developed consciousness, and obviously it's different times in different parts of the world. But Homo sapiens itself clearly goes back hundreds of thousands of years, even though they're not written records that long. And maybe it's even pushing towards a million. And so the question of when did the diversity arise is to do, of course, with the, well, that I have no, I do not know, but I mean, there are theories as to when the different racial groups did arise.
Could I just interrupt for a moment? The god of white countenance, the god of light countenance won the battle, and that quantity that he manifested became manifest. So in the modern world, are we looking at finally obliterating ourselves with a nuclear bomb or getting
I think we're going to have another session in the next conference for this question,
yes,
so that Professor Bernard Carr has time to do research on it. So in the meantime, we're going to be closing this session. And thank you very much to the wonderful speaker and our moderator and all of you for your kind attention. So thank you.
Professor Carr, just one thing. If Barack Obama gets to hear about this conference, will you let him know about the inscriptions on the pyramids, because it might help him exit his position as the
certainly think about it, yes.
That's a great thought. He will be stepping down by January. Thank you. So, and in any case, there will be a coffee break. And since somebody mentioned about the book, do look out for the book by Anita Murjani, who also gave it an incredible account of her near-death experience and how she came out of it and all her tumors disappeared. So you guys will be disappearing very soon for half an hour, and do come back for the 2:30 session, and which I'll be handing back to Tracy. So I'd like to take this opportunity to thank Cecilia and her committee, Arjun Brahm, and all the wonderful people here for an enjoyable time. And do forgive me for any of the mistakes. And I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have. Thank you very much.